हरि सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 16. Rajanath, why is bhakti not accorded everywhere in the Vedic literatures a preeminent position in spiritual science? For instance, in the Upanishads, there are Mahavakyas such as I, Jiva's soul, am the same nature as Brahman. And, oh, Svetaketu, you are that Brahman. Therefore, where is the mistake if mukti is presented as the highest sadhya? Raghunath Das Babaji, I have already explained that there are different sadhya proposed in the Vedas according to the variety of human predispositions. As long as the yearning for bhakti is strongly alive in a person, he cannot acknowledge even the existence of mukti. For such essentially minded persons, there are also sufficient supportive statements in scriptures. For example, the Apastamba Shrauta Sutra 2.1.1 declares, those who observe the vow of Chaturmasya obtain perpetual residence in heaven. Does this then imply that the desire for mukti is reprehensible? Simply because the bhakti oppressed karmis are unable to find any clue of mukti in the Vedas, should it then be concluded the Vedas are silent about mukti? In fact, the truth is that some rishis on the subject of karma have advised those who are obsessed with bhakti to take up the karmakanda performances of the Vedas, seeing that such sensually minded persons are uninterested in and incapable of cultivating the vairagya necessary to achieve mukti. These instructions were compiled to help those neophytes in spiritual life to develop faith in the Vedic prescriptions. See, because one of the first things, if you don't have faith in authority, nothing is going to function. That's one of the main difficulties that the neophyte has. If he doesn't have that problem, then great, he'll advance quite quickly. But if he in any way has this problem with what they call nowadays authority issues, those will impinge on his spiritual life. Because the point is God is authority, right? And then he's represented by Lord Nityananda and by Radharani. Right, and then by the parampara, the acharyas, the scriptures, the saintly persons of yore, the saintly persons of present day. So if we have problems with any of that, there'll be a problem. We can't have no problems with them and then have problems with a temple president, a parent, any kind of authority at the job. Means it's one package. That's all. Does that make sense? You don't like hot soup, you won't like hot tea. It's not that I like one, but I don't like the other. You don't like hot. That's all. It doesn't matter what form it's in. Does that make sense? So authority is one principle. If you have problem with your parents, you'll have problem with your temple president, you'll have problem with your boss at work, you'll have problem with your guru, you'll have problem with the parampara, you'll have problem with Krishna. That's all. It's one package. Now, you might find that some areas are easier to work on. It's easier to accept, okay, Krishna's God, I can accept that. But my parents, that's another story. But the point is it's one package. So that's why it's so important that this principle of authority is being supported. Does that make sense? Even if it means to accept it, you're accepting sense gratification. Does that make sense? In other words, sense means, even though we'll put it the other way, oh no, as long as I'm a good moralist, but and I have no faith in authority, but I'm a good moralist, I'm actually in a superior position. But actually, according to Shastra, you're not in a superior position. Right? Means we worked out that a moralistic theist is on the bottom of the barrel when it comes to spiritual life. They're the top of the gross materialists, of course. A theist, a moralist who accepts that there's a supreme authority in the form of God is the top of the materialists. But he's the, and that's where you can begin spiritual life, but he's the bottom of the spiritualists. I mean bottom. I don't mean that there's some glorious, no, pranamoy is the bottom. We're trying to get to Anandamoy, which is five levels of consciousness. Anandamoy is five. The theistic moralist is number two. Right? Two out of five stars is not good. If we say, how did the movie do? Oh, two out of five. You say it was a bomb. At least got to be three out of five. Right? That's Dharma. At least now, okay, now it starts, that's human. You become human at 3 out of 5. You're not human at 2 out of 5. You're a nice animal. Right? Right? Deers are nice animals, right? They're pleasant, nice, you know, cute like that. They don't bite. They don't do anything wrong. Right? They're nice. Like that. Yeah.
Due to false ego and envy?
Due to false ego and envy, the lack of authority. Yeah, I mean, everything's due to false ego and envy, right? Because, I mean, if you look at it, is the false ego is, I'm the controller and enjoyer, right? And so to do that means you have to be envious of Krishna, who's the authority. So it's inherent being in the material world. So because we're trying, because if you get rid of that, you actually correct everything. You know what I'm saying? The other things will go away just by practice. You know what I'm saying? So we see from the scriptures, the principle of authority is the strongest. Like that. That's probably one thing you could say about present day and previous practices. Now everybody's very nice, touchy-feely's really good, you know, all kinds of things in place to control and see that nobody actually gets any power at all. You know, all these nice things are in place. But the one thing lacking means lacking to the point of, like, you know, insanity is acceptance of authority. Right? Means vox populi, bang, bang. That's a given. Hands down. Like that. If it's vox populi, it's authority. But the unfortunate thing is that is not authority at all. That's, you know, just because a bunch of animals are doing it doesn't mean it's authority. You know, just because the animals chant Hare Krishna doesn't mean it's authority either. Right? And we may say, oh, how can you say that? Fifth canto, there's animals in there talking about how they're surrendered to Krishna and everything like that. That's the fabulous thing about devotional service. Animals can do it. Right? We're the example. Right? Varnashram means you've started human life. As far, socially. I'm not saying spiritually. Anybody who's accepted chanting and all that is spiritually human. But socially, that would be a real stretch to try to say that the Western culture is culture. That is human. It's very hard to say. And I'm saying, okay, you got a stainless steel sink, you know, your place doesn't look like a bomb hit it. Okay, so what? But are they clean? It looks clean, but are they pure? No. You know what I'm saying? So that the point is that it's that purity that makes the difference, not the cleanliness. You know what I'm saying? Clean meaning it looks tidy and nice. You know what I'm saying? It means, I don't know, you have a thing in English, it's called spit polish. Have you ever heard of that? You know, like that. And then you get, that looks nice and shiny, right? It goes on all the time. You know? You know what I'm saying? After they eat, what do? You wipe it on a napkin.
And if you're really high class, you have a little bowl with some lemon in it. Right? Does that mean, you understand? You're not actually clean. It's a, you don't see anything. It doesn't smell. But it's not pure. That's why the term is used, malecha. Right? Does that make sense? You translate that into English, it's called Western culture. Right. Does that make sense? So the point being is, that's secondary. That doesn't. That's not the actual main thing, because even if someone doesn't know all these things, but they're chanting, they're still rightly situated. You know what I'm saying? So the point is not that they're not following all these little details. The point is that before, there was such a respect for authority. You know what I'm saying? There was such a respect for authority. Two devotees be arguing over something, and the third one come along and said, no, but Prabhupada said like this. Bang, the argument is over that in that nanosecond. And no one's doubting and grumbling. Both sides are, oh. Does that make sense? It's just, you know, the temple president said it. A second initiated devotee said it. The respect that we had for second initiated devotees, I don't think we have for temple presidents now. We might attribute that to a sannyasi, and I'm not joking. Like that. And how we dealt with the temple president is basically how we deal with gurus nowadays. And how we dealt with sannyasis, that was even beyond that. That would be gurus on a Vyas Puja day. You know, or when they come and you greet them and wash your feet. You know, and how we dealt with Prabhupada, you just don't even see it. It's not there. You understand? So the respect for authority, that was just, that was the basis. Right? It's there. Prabhupada said it. It's in the books. The Acharyas said it. It's not so much that he left, because there was always a few that even then had a problem with it, like that. And that was, you know, became manifest in 87. You know, I mean, in other words, people who have authority issues have always had them, but it's just that they were in the minority. Now it's the majority. You know what I'm saying? Because it's the popular thing. That's the modern thing. Don't trust anybody. You know, of course, you can't say it like that. Now they have new terms for it. So it sounds all great. But my point is that the establishment of authority is so important, because the point is what is the Vedic literature establishing? Vedic literature is establishing simply things that Krishna likes. That's all. One of the 64 qualities of Krishna is he follows the Vedic literatures. Right? Does that make sense? It's just like this. Let's say there's a bunch of kids, and they make up their own game, and they really like this game. Okay? Now, if they write that game down, and you know, on a piece of paper, right? Then all it's doing is documenting what they do. So you can say is that they follow the rules of the game. But actually, the rules of the game are what they do naturally. So the Shastra is what Krishna does naturally. Does that make sense? So that's why it's so important, authority. It means in the Nectar of Instruction, in the eighth verse, that Rupa Goswami is saying the essence of devotional life, the whole essence, is that you're always hearing, chanting, remembering the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of the Lord in the association of devotees, following the footsteps of the advanced devotees of Vrindavan. That's it. That's the essence. So all this is just trying to convince us of that. But now here, if we don't accept the guru and we don't accept the Lord's associates as authority, we don't accept that this process of chanting, that detail is authority, then how's it going to function? Right? And that's coming because we don't accept authority, period. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, why is it we follow the law? It's only because we'll get in trouble. Not that we actually think I should do like this. You know what I'm saying? How many people park in the right place and do all the right things because they think this is what I should do? Or if I don't do that, I'll get in trouble. You understand? So that means there's not an acceptance of authority. It means you respect it because otherwise it's bigger than you and you'll get in trouble. But if it's not bigger than you, who cares? You know what I'm saying? Or they don't know. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the idea here is, therefore, since the scriptures are explaining what Krishna likes to do, therefore, the scriptures will recommend the karma kanda, jnana kanda, upasana kandas are there for that different levels of development so that they have faith in the scripture. Right? And all they're doing is giving them faith. The scripture is actually only giving them faith in the principle, not in the detail, but they take it as the detail. Like that, because the point is, those who observe the vow of Chaturmasi obtain perpetual residence in heaven. Okay? So the point of Chaturmasi, the main points of Chaturmasi are hearing and chanting, associating with devotees, like that. You know, in other words, reducing the physical engagement to engage more in spiritual. That's actually the principle. Now, is that against anything spiritual? Anything devotional? No. But the detail may not be what someone on that platform would do. But one gets faith in it, so after a while one sees the principle is more important than the detail. And then that's when he moves up. Right? So in other words, when you understand that it's the austerity, it's sacrifice, it's the not being attached to things, it's about having the proper understanding, then you move to the next level. Right? It's a slow path, but at least it's a path. You know? At least something's going on. It's slow, but it gets there. It may take some millions of lifetimes, but does that make sense? So it's not wrong in that. So that's what he's pointing out, is that the scriptures are never wrong. That they've taken that path, it's not wrong. But it's not what we as Vaishnavas would do, because we're on the quick path, so we won't deal with that. We understand the principle is authority, and that's spiritual authority. And so we've already accepted that. And so then we follow the rules and regulations that are connected and given. Does that make sense? So it works really nicely. So the idea is that these levels of sadhya are there so that there is the principle of having a goal, right? A person without a goal gets nothing done, right? That was the lowest level in yoga, right? Is the person where the passion and ignorance are perfectly balanced, right? Sounds good, yeah. Perfectly balanced. The perfect balance of passion and ignorance. Yeah. But they can't do anything because they have the desire to do, but the ignorance, then they can't tell what's the right thing to do or not, or they don't have the initiative, and so nothing gets done. Right? So better than that is a guy who's purely situated in ignorance. Because at least he doesn't do anything, you know, I mean, too stupid, because he's too much in ignorance to do something stupid. Right? Then better than that, where passion is more prominent than ignorance, because then at least he's accomplishing something.
Advanced.
Yeah. You like that? What was it? This difference? One was disturbed and the other is restless. Yeah, so the restless is better than the disturbed, right? Because the disturbed is disturbed because they can't do anything. They want everything but can't get anything. Right? And the restless is, you know, he wants to do this, he wants to do that, but he's working, he's always doing, so he's like that. But best is then when that comes to a balance, and goodness becomes the prominent. Right? So when goodness is the prominence, then there's focus, then one's properly following and everything like that. So the thing is there's acceptance of authority when there's goodness. If there's not acceptance of authority, then what does that mean? Why would I not accept authority? It's got to either be due to ignorance or due to passion. But even someone who's smart in passion accepts authority. Mm. Because there's other persons who've gone before you who have made a sincere effort to enjoy this world. And they've gotten some results. So therefore, if you follow their authority, then you'll get it. So the principle is authority is important. It's more important than these other aspects. You know what I'm saying? In other words, everything's important. Right? It means, why is morality important? Right?
Because it works.
Because it works. And that's what's nice to offer to Krishna. If you're going to offer something to Krishna, you offer something nice. So something moral is better than something immoral. Does that make sense? That's the reason. Not that morality is great on its own. That's for a materialist. The materialist is only moral because he thinks it's better. If he didn't think it was better, he wouldn't be moral. So better, he's moral. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Is there a distinction between, following authority for oneself or following authority because it's authority? It seems that the passionate is not really following authority.
No, passion is following authority, but they want the benefit from it. So once they get the benefit, they don't care for authority.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why you see is that it's not actually pure, even mukti, because once they get liberation, they don't care about authority. So authority is only a step to get what you want.
So could we say that following authority in passion is naimittic?
It's naimittic, yeah.
And in goodness it's nitya?
Goodness is nitya, but same time as we saw before, as the smartas are doing everything perfectly.
Mm.
So it's only when it's done in pure goodness, that's nitya.
Yeah.
Because the point is authority is always there. The guru is always the guru eternally.
Mm.
They're always, it means Rupa Goswami is eternally the authority.
Mm.
Srila Prabhupada is eternally the authority, the previous authority, eternally the authority.
Yes.
Does that make sense? Mm. Above them, the asas are their authority. Above that, Radharani.
Mm.
That's eternally going to be there. And it's not a problem. That's a relationship. There's something very interesting, just because, we'll get into it more, but just to bring it up now, is that then after that, Rupa Goswami goes on to explain about that. Oh no, it's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is explaining in his purport to the verse that He's explaining Bhav Sadhana, but he's explaining it from all the way down at Shraddha, down at the point of the neophyte. That when one hears about one's position as servant of Krishna, then one takes that up, and then with time one adjusts with that, and then one's comfortable with it. Then one's absorbed in remembering Krishna, right?
Mm.
The Smarana Dasa. So then that develops, that becomes more and more. So then, that starts all the way through. It means from down, but as one gets a taste, then that becomes solid, and then from that taste and this attachment, then it turns into bhav, ecstasy. So then we see that's the fuller manifestation of the hearing about what your nature. So the point is, you've heard about, I'm this particular, person in the lila, I have this body, I have all these different things. Like this. This is my position. But it doesn't say, the interesting thing is Rupa Goswami is mentioning, that you only get to know Krishna. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. When one crosses samadhi, that one's always absorbed in Krishna. Totally. Then one actually knows one's position. But we can say, no, with the Srup Siddhi, I know my position. No, you know the sambandha aspect of it. But the point is you have to know the Abhideya and Prayojana aspect of it. A relationship means like, I know I'm, the son of my father, or, I'm, this person's brother, or, does that make sense? I know that, but the point is you don't really know it until you're acting within it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then, when one comes to the point of samadhi, one's fully absorbed, then one actually knows one's relationship with Krishna. Right, because then one's always absorbed in Krishna, because Krishna is always absorbed in the living entity.
Mm-hmm.
The weakness is not him, the weakness is us. We're the one who's not thinking of him. He's thinking of us. He's sitting in the heart. He's not overwhelmed by the modes and nature. So he knows, what's going on. He knows who we are. He knows what's happening. Does that make sense? Right? So the idea then being that this accepting authority, having faith, is the first step. Faith is where the whole process is from. Having an appreciation for authority or an individual, that's where relationships start. Right. So having that faith, having that appreciation, that's the basis of everything.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what the scriptures are doing. And they're not wrong.
No.
Right? They're not wrong in what they say. The point is yes, it is. You absorb chaturmasya, you get perpetual residence in heaven. But who wants perpetual residence in heaven? But a karma, but a person interested in sense gratification does.
Mm.
You can basically say most of the theistic world, religious world, as it is today, wants perpetual residence in heaven.
Yes.
That's the reason that they're trying to be good in whatever way they know good is. Whatever is identified amongst their culture or their religion as good, they're trying to do it simply because they'll get perpetual residence in heaven. Yes?
All right, so where is the balance between intelligence that we use in acceptance of authorities and then doubting everything, like every person, and going paranoid about it?
Okay. Means the point is that you have what works and you have the position of authority. See, there's a difference between the principle of authority and an individual in the position of authority. See, if one's intelligence is developed, one can tell that there's non-difference, but there's difference. So just that you have a person in authority, just because that person is not behaving right, it doesn't mean authority is, the principle of authority is affected. You know what I'm saying? The person is taking money and going down and buying some alcohol. So that means then the person who sold the alcohol, that money that he has, that's bad money. Right? But it doesn't mean money in principle is bad. It just means that particular money's bad. So therefore, if that person gives you a donation, that's bad money. So you discriminate and give that to the deities. You won't use it personally. Right? But somebody that does a proper job, you know, proper business in that, gets money and gives you money, that's good money. So just because there's bad money doesn't mean that the principle of money goes bad. So the same way, is because one authority acts badly doesn't mean the principle of authority goes bad. That's generally what happens. The temple president dealt badly, so therefore they don't trust authority. There's a difference there. So emotionally it puts it all together, but intellectually one shouldn't. So that's the balance. So to be able to discriminate what's right and wrong, that's good. But then to emotionally therefore put right and wrong and everything in that category, that's where the problem comes up. Right? And if one finds fault in everything, that's easy to do. Generally speaking, that's the fun part, is those who find fault in everything generally consider themselves more intelligent and superior than everybody else, because they're able to find fault in everything.
Hmm.
But the point is so was Duryodhana. And generally he's not known as a great role model. You know what I'm saying? So the ability to find fault in everything is not actually so special. It means that you can see a fault, that's intelligent. But if you can't see the good also, then that's lack of, you know, proper use of the intelligence. Because the point is that the person who can find fault in everything does have the ability to find good in everything. Because it's the same principle. You know what I'm saying? It's the same principle. You know how to, like, let's say I go into the market and I can tell you which vegetables are bad. You know? Like that. This one's got a bruise on it. This one's funny shape. This one's got this, that. I can find that. But that means they have the potential to figure out what's actually a good vegetable. It's just a matter of either they're not applying or they don't know. But they could learn very easily. Because someone who is so expert at finding fault in everything, they have to be intelligent. And they have to always be conscious. You know? So that means they already have a good start. It's just being misapplied. Right? So you can turn around. Because I have seen persons who are so critical of everything and notice everything. And after a while, when they start noticing good, you just need to become purified, they don't worry about the others. Not that they can't notice it. It's not their interest. They're just not interested. So I've actually seen persons come from being super critical into being super pleasant. Like that. I mean, it took a few years. You know? Yeah. But it worked.
We got time.
Yeah. Okay, so does that make sense? So in other words, if we have faith in the Vedic literature,
then we'll be able to actually progress. Because the Vedic literature is telling us, chant Hare Krishna, and you'll develop love for Krishna. Right? That's where it's coming from. So they all say this. So even though it says, you know, come up, he'll say it. But just like there, they say, you know, I am the nature of Brahman. You know, what is it called? Aham Brahmasmi, right? And the other one is you are that, you know, Tattvamasi, right? So means yes, you are Brahman and you are that. But the point is you are a small part of that. It means you are that, but you're a small part. Just like you can say yes, you are, you know, American. You know, but that doesn't mean you are America. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So the thing is you are that. Yes, you are Brahman, but you're a part of Brahman, right? So they're not actually saying anything wrong. But the point is because of their sadhya, they interpret it wrong. They interpret it wrong. They interpret it that this verse is only applying to that. You know, just like if I say, you know, here, those who observe the vow of Chaturmasi obtain perpetual residence in heaven. If I say, you know, he who takes a, you know, bottle of, you know, strawberry jelly and pours it over his head will have very sticky hair. Is it correct? Yeah. Now, would you want to do that? No. If you were 3 years old?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. You understand? That's what the Vedic literatures are doing. They're simply presenting this and that. But the point is we develop faith and authority because it does that. We do it, we get the result. You do this, they go to the heaven, they get faith. Does that make sense? So that's why the Vedic literatures does it. But it's always saying, what's the actual point? But the point is people don't catch it, people don't accept it, people don't take it. That's the...
People don't know.
People, yes, they don't. Means they don't specifically want to know. So the thing is by telling them if they'll lose faith. That's the ninth point. Don't preach the glories of the holy name to the faithless. So therefore, if someone's totally absorbed in sense gratification, you don't preach to them the glories of the holy name. Right? If he's totally in the liberty, you don't preach the glories. You mention it to him that by chanting you get the best benefit. You know? But if he doesn't take it, you don't explain more. So that's what the Vedas do. They throw out the verses to explain it. Those who catch it, catch that verse. And then they want to know more about that. So then they're not going to look at Karmakanda. They're going to look, where is this knowledge applied? Right? So generally they'll go to Upanishads. Because that'll take, and then within the Upanishads they see what's actually dealing with the Supreme Absolute Truth as a person. They'll look for that, and then finding that, then they'll be able to appreciate Bhagavatam. Does that make sense? So it's a natural step, but Prabhupada's made it so easy, you know. So therefore, when talking about Gita, then we're introduced into all the aspects of spiritual life and the higher principles, Upanishads, and we're introduced into that. So it doesn't matter what we're doing, the interpretation, the mimamsa, is, you know, Vedanta.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in other words, I can take a verse, and depending upon what is my perspective, I will interpret the verse. Right? But the point is, so that's why sometimes devotees will complain, no, but the Shastra, it says all these contradictory things. None of them are contradictory. It's just speaking to a particular audience.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? It's just like, let's say you have a PhD in you know, grammar, right? But when they're talking to their grandchild who's like 3 years old, they may not use all that nice knowledge. They might speak very simply. So you could say, this is such a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she's talking to the students, which are not so close, they talk all this thing to someone who's, you know, close and intimate. They're using this, you know, not very well-constructed language. So actually, the not very well-constructed language would be the higher principle. You know what I'm saying? You can get all kinds of funny, contradictory things.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it depends upon the situation, who you're speaking to.
Mm-hmm.
So the person that has faith in spiritual life, then the interpretation is always in that way. The person who doesn't, then you might give others. But because people don't really have the time, in Kali Yuga, you don't bother with all these other forms. You just give it in a way that they can appreciate it. Right? In other words, you use the language that goes with it. If you're talking to a karmi, you use karmi language. If you're talking to a gyani, you use gyani language. If you're talking to a devotee, you use devotee language. Does that make sense? No? That's the idea. Okay. Jnana is superior to karma, as it bestows mukti. Nevertheless, right? In other words, being out of the material world is better than being in the material world. That's the superiority. Right? Nevertheless, the Karmakanda section of the Vedas extensively praises the performance of karma and refrains from admitting to the superiority of jnana, and thus the superiority of mukti over bhakti. In the Jnanakanda, in other words, it very much praises karma, but it doesn't talk about jnana. It may mention something, but it doesn't get into detail, because if you get into detail, people won't do karma. Right? And if they don't do karma, they'll do vikarma. That's the point. They'll either do pious activities or impious. But what we're saying is, instead of doing pious activities, doing devotional activities. Devotion already includes pious. The pious doesn't include devotion. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is the person will do. If I say, you do chaturmasya, you obtain perpetual residence in heaven, the person will actually try to do something pious. But now, if they're not actually ready for jnana, they're not interested in at all, and then I say, yeah, that's true, but perpetual means, 10,000 years, or whatever it is, according to your piety, and then after that you'll come back here. So it's not actually perpetual meaning that. Perpetual just means that it's long. Like that. So then the person might think, wow, so what's the use of doing that? And I'll go, yes, that's the point. You should take up mukti. And they'll go, why should I do that? I'll just do sinful activities, because then I get immediate sense of it. You understand? So that's why they don't push it too much. They'll throw it out. Because the idea is that the person studying Karmakanda at some point will understand Jnanakanda is higher. So there has to be something there. But the volume of it is very, very minimal. Like we saw with Manu, when it's explaining about animal sacrifices, it's talking about how it's not sinful. It doesn't say there's not going to be a reaction. He very clearly says there'll be a reaction. But he says it won't be sinful. So all those verses that explain that, person's thinking, yes, this is great. But at the end, it very says that there'll be a reaction, because I kill you, you kill me. That's a reaction. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You go to the heavenly planets, you this and that, but you're going to be the goat, and he's going to be the one cutting off your head. So that's part of the deal. Right? Therefore, someone who's thoughtful will think about it. Someone who's not won't, because there's only a couple of verses. They'll go, oh, yeah, right, and then move on. Does that make sense? That's how we do it. It means you have an idea for sense gratification. Then there's also so many obstacles, there's so many considerations, but we don't worry about them. Oh yeah, it'll be fine. We'll worry about that later. All those different kinds of... We have so many nice lines that we say. Like that. And so then we get involved. Then later we're grumbling about it, for however long it takes to adjust that. Does that make sense? Because we're looking at the positive. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is that the idea is to be inspired. Because the point is you have to be inspired to do the devotional service, and then the natural maturation of devotional is inspired devotional, spontaneous devotional service. So that inspiration is important, and that inspiration and following authority, those are all very important. Does that make sense? Yes.
Srila Prabhupada, in his purports, we saw a lot of introduction, jumps right into devotional service, and
right.
Even some people, they understand, Sanskrit and so many things, and they say it's not written Chant Hare Krishna, but then Srila Prabhupada translates it, and even if it's not there, then he just gives it.
No, it is there. It's just that, in other words, he's not adding something that's not there. It's just that the particular terminology being used is terminology for some other aspect. It's an aspect of karma or jnana. It's just the language. So all it is that it's another synonym within that. Because that's also an expertise of knowing Sanskrit, is that we have to remember that Monier Williams was a materialistic guy. And so he's not very expert necessarily in the broad range of meanings. And even though it may be there, the idea is they're trying to be more literal, because then there's an idea amongst the Sanskritists, the more literal it is, the better. Right? You know, because that's there. If you ever see generally what Sanskritists translate, it's not poetic at all. You need an editor to make it poetic. Like that. So, but the point is in the Vedic, the concept nirukta means what's the obscure meaning. Like that. So when you're dealing with one thing, you can see the principles that are going on. It means, in other words, whatever is being discussed here, there's principles being discussed. But they're going through a particular chronology of details according to the individual that they're dealing with, according to the question, according to the situation. And so the thing is to be able to see what's that principle that's going on. Like, let's say, if I say Krishna's greatness, Krishna's beauty, and that love for Krishna. Okay? I might think it's three separate things. Okay, yeah, but it could have been any other three. But you've just mentioned Samandabhide and Prajan, Satchitananda. You know what I'm saying? So the ability to be able to see those things, that's what Prabhupada's doing. So all it is that may say his greatness, and then he'll say the personality of Godhead. You know, or his beauty, and he'll say the Lord's pastimes. Because the point is beauty is something that you're seeing, appreciating, interacting with. You know, if something's done really well, you say it's beautiful. You know what I'm saying? So those kind of things, that's what Prabhupada's doing. He's not adding in something. That the scholars will say, just because they're not actually that good a scholar. They may be the best around. He's the top Sanskrit scholar in, you know, Harvard, but who cares? That's in Harvard. Yeah, it's just like in a village of blind men, a guy with one eye is king. You know? What I'm saying is that... So that's what's going on. You know, there's guys in India that talk Sanskrit as their language. So the subtleties that are there, and the people that know the nyaya, the people that know the grammar, their understanding of Sanskrit is so far beyond these people. It's like, you know, first grade and university. But because, you know, they're the professor, so they're in first grade. Everybody else is in nursery school, you know, or even what's, you know, if they have anything before that, you know, when you do when you're 6 months old, you know. Japan's got that stuff. I don't know, you know, how to go to school at 6 months old. Does that make sense? So that's what we're dealing with. Is that they don't know that much. But it's not that they're not as intelligent as, let's say, that Sanskrit person. But they don't have the knowledge. Because they don't have the association, they don't have the Vedic authority. So we're not saying they're stupid. We're just saying is the amount of knowledge they have is not very great. But they're very good at, they're not very great knowledge. You know, so he's the best at that. Is that okay? So Prabhupada never actually... He doesn't change. He just gives a synonym that's actually dealing with the principle that's being done there. Because you have to see also the context of the verses, what's going on, and that it's not just that on its own. So that's what's being discussed in there. And so therefore he's using that language. Because depending upon who's talking also, different times, many times terminology should be used. Let's say it's, you know, let's say Markandeya is speaking. It might be more of using Jnana language. Does that make sense? Yeah. So therefore, then you may bring out the devotional words for it, because we're used to those. Is that okay?
Yeah.
In the Gyanakanda chapter of the Vedas, knowledge of mukti has been praised as shown by the verses already quoted. Therefore, jnana appears there as superior to karma. Similarly, in the relevant section of the Veda, bhakti is expounded as clearly excelling jnana and karma. Vrajanath, is it actually possible that the Mahavakya that I have just quoted present an ultimately false sadhya and sadhana concept? Right. So now, have these points that of jnana that are, you know, so well appreciated by Shankara and his followers, are they possibly wrong in that they're not given the ultimate sadhya and the ultimate sadhana? Raghunath Das Babaji, are these Vedic edicts that you call the Mahavakyas really so excellent? And do they actually predominate over other Vedic testimonies, right? Because he called them Mahavakyas, but actually the Acharyas don't call them Mahavakyas. Saying, you are Brahman, that's not a Mahavakya. You know? Does that make sense? Mm. You know, it's just stating a fact. Mm. No. Where is such an opinion upheld? Certainly within the Vedas themselves, these aphorisms have not been designated as Mahavakyas. The Veda hasn't pointed out this is a Mahavakya.
Mm.
Right? It's just Shankara has taken them as Mahavakyas.
Yeah.
And made them into. In other words, you have people that are Buddhists, and you're trying to make them into. You're trying to make them follow the authority of the Vedas. What is the problem with a Buddhist? Right? It means he's very austere, right? He's very nice guy, pleasant, doesn't fight, doesn't make trouble, right? So many nice qualities. But what's the main outstanding fault?
He's an atheist.
He's an atheist. He doesn't accept the authority of the Veda. So, of the two. Right? In other words, being an impersonalist or not accepting the Veda, which of the two is the biggest problem?
Not accepting
the Veda. So therefore, leave them Buddhists, but have them get their Buddhistic concept based on the Veda. So therefore, you have to pick those things that they'll take. Yes, this is something I can relate to that. Because, as I mentioned, we were once talking to some scholars, big scholars, Shankarite scholars. You know, not just Mayavadis you meet on the road or someone in Rishikesh. It means the guys that actually teach Mayavad philosophy to the Mayavadi gurus, means like in the Shankara line. Those kind of Mayavadi scholars. Right? And we asked them, did Shankaracharya write this book talking about Radha and Krishna and how bhakti is supreme? And they say yes. But then their next comment is, we have no idea why. You know, it's just, why would he do that? So it's just one of those things, if you don't ask, you know, what is it? Don't ask, don't tell. Yeah, that's it. They just leave it at that. They're not going to tell you about it. You know, like that. But, you know, because they're actually proper pundits, they will say, yes, it's there. But they have no idea. So it doesn't. They can't relate to it at all. So he's written it for those who actually understand what he's trying to say and then will take up devotion. But for those who are satisfied and actually just being Vedic Buddhists, basically like that, then he's given a very excellent system how they can think, I am, you know, still following my philosophy, but now it's based on the Veda. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a step forward, because instead of being void, then it's Brahman. Right? You know, instead of being darkness, it's light. Right? You know, so therefore the Upanishad come from the darkness to the light. Right? You know, go to any yoga studio and they'll chant that before they start. Right? Okay. Clearly then, the Acharyas of the path of jnana have inventively designated these statements as Mahavakyas for the sole purpose of lending weight to their own philosophy, right? Inventively. Mm-hmm. Means they probably, factually, the pranava, the seed vibration om, is the only an actual Mahavakya to which all other Vedic statements are related. Because the Mahavakya means that statements, that vakya, by which all other statements have their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the Vedas, they proclaim om. As a, even in Manasamhita, which is not a philosophical literature, says the pranava is the essential. So pranava is the Mahavakya, because without Om, nothing has meaning in the Vedic literatures. You can't chant the verse without Om. Right? It doesn't have a meaning. Right? And so they'll take it as Om is just, you know, it has these aspects. It's these three letters, but it's the Brahma. But on the higher levels, A-U-M, it's the Supreme Lord. It's his internal potency and the Jivas. Right? And there's more detail, which I don't remember. You have the Chandra Bindu. So the Chandra is one thing and the Bindu is another thing. I think they have to do with the pastimes. So Om includes the Lord, his internal potency, the Jivas, and the pastimes between them. That's the Mahavakya. Right? Is that in the Vedic literature?
So there's only one?
Yeah, there's only one. It doesn't say Mahavakyas. It says Mahavakya. Yeah. Also, however, it would be exaggerated to say that every statement of the Vedas is a Mahavakya. Excuse me. However, it would not be exaggerated to say that every statement of the Vedas is a Mahavakya. To discriminate, designate one Vedic aphorism as Mahavakya and the others as Samanyavakya, ordinary, is simply mental speculation, because nothing's ordinary in the Veda. Yeah. All it is just what is the root of all the others. Because if we see, when it's explained by Lord Chaitanya, that you have the Maha Mantra, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, that's the original mantra. Mm. The expansion of that mantra is the Namatmika mantras. It means you have Nama, and then you have Namatmika. Namatmika means those mantras that the name is their life. So that's the Kama Gayatri. The Kama Gayatri then expands into the Gopal mantra and then all the other Gayatris. Right? Right down to the Brahma Gayatri. Because the Brahma Gayatri will be the aspect of the Lord as Brahman. Right? It means in a general sense. We also understand how it's Krishna. Right? But the point is that's then, and it's, so that comes, so then that comes down as then you have Burbu Vaswa and you have Om. So that means by Om, that expands into Burbu Vaswa, that expands into Gayatri. So Om is what comes through into the material world first. So that actually, therefore, is the Mahavakya. Right? But then Om expands into Burbu Vaswa. Expands into the Gayatri, expands into the Purusha Shukta, expands into the Veda. Right? Does that make sense? So like that, then you can say, therefore, it's the Mahavakya, because everything is based on it. At the same time, is there's nothing ordinary, there's nothing samanya about any of the Vedic literature. So therefore, you could say it's all Mahavakya, but still there's the Maha Mahavakya. You know, like that. Like that. This bigoted provincialism, that's a good one, is surely an offense against the Vedas. Actually, in the relevant khandhas, the Vedas praise karma as well as mukti and give suitable versions of the sadhya and sadhana practice for the respective attainment of both these goals. In other words, when we talk about it, it's a matter of they're bona fide, but it's not the highest. It's not actually the purpose. The real purpose of all the Vedic sadhana and sadhya is to bring you to the point of bhakti. That's actually its purpose. So in that way, it's good. So someone who is not able to function on those higher, then to accept the lower, at least they're on the path, going in the proper direction. Right? You're supposed to be on Krishna's path going towards him, not on Krishna's path going away from him. You can say, hey, I'm on the path. Yeah, but you're going to hell. That's the wrong way. You're supposed to be on the path going towards Krishna. Right? Like that. So the thing is that one has to deal with it very delicately. In other words, bhakti is the highest, but it's not that these other aspects are wrong. They're correct for the particular thing. It's not that first grade math is wrong, but it's what you teach the first grader. You know what I'm saying? If I take, okay, they have this rock and you have this rock. Okay, this is one rock. And this is one rock. Okay, how many rocks do I have now? There's two. So is that wrong? But do I pull out rocks, you know, for the math major in university? No. Now you pull out for Leakey, right? You know, but you don't pull them out for the math major. You know, the is that that's the anthropologist who says we all came from apes?
Yeah.
So for him, you pull out rocks. He loves rocks. Wow, hey, check that out. Oh, that's from there. You know. It's not, yeah. Right. So therefore, it has to be very carefully done in that one is trying to establish what's the higher principle without insulting the Vedas. We have to be very, very careful there. Does that make sense? Just like I said before, as we were mentioning before, the person who cleans their house nicely and has a tidy house is better than the person that looks like a bomb hit it. But the point is it's still not, why are they doing it? Why do they have a clean house? Right? You ask a question, why is your house clean? Are they going to say, somebody might say cleanliness is next to godliness if they, you know, happen to be some kind of a, you know, Bible person. But otherwise, there's a good chance they're just going to say it's civilized, it's cultured, or this is what my parents did, or, you know, it's the proper thing to do, or I like it. They're never going to say, because the Vedas recommend it. Right? You're going to find that? No, right? Isn't it like, you know, you go, what is it? You can never say it right, but the, what is it? The Champs-Élysées. Okay, so there's people living there. If you go into the houses, they're quite very tidy and kept very nicely, right? You know, that Fabergé egg is kept there very well, you know, it's like that. But if you ask them why it's clean, it'll just be it's cultured, it's high class, it's this, it's that. They'll never say, I'm doing because the Vedas say. Yeah, so that's the problem, is that it's nice, it's good, but it's and it's superior to someone else. But it's still not rightly situated because they could change, right? Means they could meet a friend who says you're too stiff, you're too this, you're too that. Let's go out and do something crazy, right? And then they've got a new understanding of life and this and that, and right, like that, isn't that? And then that's when we pan back and the credits come, right? You know, you don't want to take it too far, right? So, no. So, but the point is that they could completely change. That's what Prabhupada says: religion can change. Because you can take what is your authority, this and that. But the point is the Veda, that's the authority. You don't want to change that. Now within that, Sanatana Dharma means you're following the Vedic authority in the way that it says it's supposed to be done. Right? Does that make sense? That's proper. That's Sanatana Dharma. Any other Dharma could change. Because otherwise, you're following the Veda, you can change from the Dharma of karma into the Dharma of Gyan. You know, you can worship demigods or not. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Like the smarter who's Vaishnav doesn't worship other demigods. But he's not actually worshiping Vishnu with devotion, but he'll call himself a Vaishnav. Right? And they do everything that we do. But they don't actually have faith that the Lord's form is eternal. So it's not actually Vaishnava. Right? So you can change. Religion can change. But the point is first, that religion should be based on the Vedas. And two, it should be based on devotion. Right? That's actually what it's for. Because that's the Sanatana Dharma. Everything else is just called Dharma. Right? Yet when the final analysis is drawn, all arbitrations are harmonized in the conclusion that only bhakti is the true and actual sadhya and sadhana. Because bhakti you can find in all the others. Right? Does that make sense?
It contains the others?
It contains the others. But its point is the way it's written, you can still find it. You know what I'm saying? Just like you have the Karmakanda Yajna, you have to have it done by Brahmins. Right? Now, point is who's a real Brahmin? A Vaishnava. Right? So, in other words, the Vedas are saying, perform your Karmakanda Yajna actually with Vaishnavas. Because they're going to instruct you in devotional service. And then you'll actually give up the Karmakanda. Right? But it doesn't happen. Does that make sense?
So right. The Karmakanda is described in such a way that there's the biggest possible possibility that they will
yes,
meet or associate with.
Yes. Persons. It's like Prachina Barhishat or King Riga. Why are they entertaining Narad Muni? Just because they kind of felt in a liberal mood that day and didn't mind strange guys walking around with musical instruments. Yes.
She says you respect sadhus.
Yes. So the Karmakanda says you respect sadhus.
Mm.
And by that, then you'll be benefited.
Mm.
Right? You give charity to a Brahmin, the amount you'll get back is so much more.
Mm.
So Narad Muni is the greatest of Brahmins, so naturally you'll get so much back. So naturally, they're going to be inclined. But it's only because of the Vedas. If Narad Muni went, you know, just, you know, somewhere in London and knocked on a door, you know, it stood there and that, like that, will they invite him in? Good chance they won't, you know. Does that make sense? You go to Texas, and they'll say, 1 minute, and they'll come back with a shotgun, right? They've already called the police, right? Just say, just wait here, you know, until the police come. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is that because of the Veda, they're following. And because of that, now they've met Narad Muni, and now they've been given devotional service. But they were technically following the Veda by having Karmakanda Brahmins come and do their yajnas. But then they never learned about bhakti. But the same situations, bhakti can be explained. Does that make sense? You're having the sages at Naimisharanya are hearing the Puranas, they're hearing the Mahabharata, and they're hearing the Bhagavatam. Same yajna. It's not that it was a different yajna. They're doing a 1,000-year yajna. So within that time, they've heard all the 18 Puranas, the Mahabharata, and everything. But they got to the Bhagavatam because they listened to sages. Does that make sense? That's why the Vedic literature is superior, because it will always lead you to something that is useful for bhakti. That's what Prabhupada says. The Kali worshipper is better situated than, let's say, a nicely practicing Christian. Because a Christian doesn't have that Vedic authority. He may have nice faith, he may have so many things, but he doesn't have that authority, so he doesn't actually have the knowledge. So if you give him the Shastra, you give him proper guru, he doesn't have the culture. You know what I'm saying? Well, the Kali Bhakta will. He respects guru, he offers obeisances, he reads the Shastra, he follows the ritual that's in the Vedas. So he knows what an Achman cup is, he knows what a bell is, he knows what all these things, he knows about washing hands, mouth, and feet. He's already doing that. Right? Cooking for the deity without cooking for yourself. He already knows all that. Does that make sense? It's just what they cook and what they do, and that's different. That's not ideal. So the culture is the same. So all you're now is adding Krishna. Well, the other one is you're adding Krishna, but where's the culture? You know what I'm saying? So it's not going to happen. Okay. The Vedas are said to be like a cow, and Sri Nanda Nandan, the son of Nanda Maharaj, is the milkman who milks her. The following statement, and the interesting thing is that's given by Shankaracharya. That's a prayer by Shankaracharya. In the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, it gives all those prayers by Shankaracharya. The Gita, I think it's called Gita Mahatmya.
Yeah.
Like that. They're prayers by that. And this is the last. No, this is not the last one. This is one that was before. Yeah, that's the one that says, you know, one Shastra, that's the Gita, one person, you know, one Lord, that's Krishna, like that. So that's Shankaracharya. So he does give indication. You know, and all the Shankarites know those prayers, say those prayers before they chant Gita and that, but they never actually catch the whole point.
So Prabhupada was quoting this in Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, yeah.
The introduction, right. Exactly this.
Yeah, yeah.
Let them be to one flag, let them be one this and that.
Yes, yes, yes. So here he's quoting that. So even though he's saying that they inventively designated, that was inventively designated because you're trying to turn Buddhists into Hindus, basically. But now he's giving what's the actual purpose. The following statement made by Sri Krishna is an absolute conclusion, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 6:46-47. A yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, greater than the fruit of worker. Therefore, Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. And of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. Right? So in other words, yogis better than all these others, but of the yogis, the bhakti yogis, the best. In the Gopal Tapanu Upanishad, Purva Vibhag 15, we find, devotional service to the Supreme Lord, Sri Govinda, is real bhajana, curbing the desires for earthly as well as heavenly sense enjoyment, absorbing the consciousness purely in Sri Krishna, the Supreme Brahman, with love is indeed unmotivated devotional service and is known as complete surrender. Right? But because it's an Upanishad, it says Sri Krishna, the Supreme Brahman. Right? Like that. But the point is being made here is devotional service is the real bhajan. So that means that's the real sadhana. Right? And developing this love for him, that is the actual sadhya. Any person who scrutinizes these Vedic postulations will automatically draw the obvious conclusion. The path of bhakti is the real sadhana. Rajana. The Karmakanda instructs its adherents to perform bhakti with faith to Ishvara, who bestows the results of all action. In the Jnanakanda, there are the sadhana, chatushtaya, one of which is bhakti, which strives after haritoshana. All right, so that means the satisfying Sri Hari. If bhakti is thus apparently employed in the achievement of bhukti and mukti, how does bhakti then uphold its claim of being the ultimate eternal goal, the highest sadhya? Right, it is naturally assumed that bhakti, first acting as the sadhana, offers bhukti and mukti, and thereafter losing its utility is abandoned. Kindly shed this light upon this topic. Because someone may say, okay, now if you say bhakti is inherently there, means not inherently there, means it's written in that you have the opportunity to come in contact with bhakti. Like that. So that means, but when you go for that goal, you give that up. When I go to the heavenly planets, I give up the sadhana. When I go to when I get liberated, I give up the sadhana. So if the sadhana included bhakti, then it was given up, so therefore it's on a lower level. Right? Someone might argue. That's his point. Raghunath Das Babaji. It is absolutely correct that in the Karmakanda section, bhakti is used as a means to obtain bhukti, and in Jnanakanda chapter, bhakti is employed to offer mukti. To appreciate this employment of bhakti, one fact must be clearly understood. No goals or results can be achieved if the Supreme Lord, the fountainhead of all energies, is not satisfied. Right? So in other words, you want bhukti, only the Lord can give it. You want mukti, only the Lord can give it. No one else can give it. Right? So the point is, and you please, and so therefore, if he's the only one that can give it, you can only please him. You have to please him. You can only please him through bhakti. So therefore, bhakti is not part of it. He won't be pleased. You won't get your result. Whatever volume of energy is found in the jiva or in matter is merely a fractional display of the potency of the Supreme Lord. Essentially, neither karma or jnana is able to satisfy the Supreme Lord properly and attract his mercy. Only bhakti is able to attract his mercy. Therefore, only when bhakti is applied as a part of the karma or jnana process do these ultimately bhakti dependent processes offer their specific results. Thus, the paths of karma and jnana harbor bhakti abhas, a mere semblance of bhakti and not shuddha bhakti. Right? Because shuddha bhakti means free from karma and jnana. Right? There's karma and jnana, it's not pure. So when it's free from that, then that's pure bhakti. So, in other words, it's mixed devotion. But because they're not actually accepting the supremacy of the Lord in the way of his form as eternal, in that relationship, therefore they're not counted as devotees. Right? Just like the smart is not. The smart is worshipping Vishnu, and it may be either go to the heavenly planets or for liberation, but he's not counted as a devotee.
So this is why they have to work so hard.
Yes. Because if you don't get it exactly right, then why? You know, in other words, if it's done in devotion, even if it's not perfect, you accept it. But if it's being done formally because you want some particular benefit from it, then it better be done exactly right. Otherwise, why they should get? Right? That's So it's a mere semblance of bhakti, not Shuddha bhakti. Right? So the devotional elements are there, but that doesn't mean that they're devotees. You can't say, oh, now so now it's devotional service. No, it's not. It's just a mere semblance. So the point is when you accept the supremacy of the Lord, his position as eternal, then that situates you on a different... Then you situate on the quick path. Right? Yes.
You say that the semblance of devotional service is just service, not devotional service?
You say you're following the ritual and it's being directed towards the Lord. But it's not the ultimate surrender. That's what I was saying before, is that... what was it? That was in the previous page. Can we just read that? That it's the highest sadhya and sadhana. Oh, yeah. That only bhakti is the true and actual sadhya and sadhana.
Yeah.
Right? All our arbitrations are harmonized in the conclusion that only bhakti is the true and actual sadhya and sadhana. Mm. Yeah, they harbor bhakti abhas. But people don't notice it, that that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't catch that that's mm-hmm. the main thing. Okay. A yaga, or a yajna, during which invocatory prayers are made, such as, O Lord Indra, O Pushana, the sun god, grant me the results of this yajna. It is bhakti abhash performance, constituted of karma, vidya, bhakti abhash. Now we're getting fancy here. Karma, vidya, bhakti abhash. Some spiritual authorities have termed this type of adulterated bhakti as karma misra bhakti. Still others have called it aropya siddha bhakti, seeking achievement through the artificial interpolation of devotion. Right, So it's important to be able to understand technically what's going on here, because the mechanics are the same. When we're saying that it's bhakti abhash, it's the same whether it's within the devotional category of a neophyte or whether it's not. The mechanics are the same. You're still approaching the Lord, and through his blessings, you're getting what you're looking for in karma and jnana.
Mm.
Right? But the difference is it's karma vidha or mukti vidha. Right?
Mm.
So, this bhakti abhash means it's a shadow of, it's a semblance of, it's not actual.
Mm.
But the difference is so, therefore, those terms we're not as used to, but we've heard aropya siddhi or karma misra. So the thing is it's karma misra, but it's basically karma that's got a touch of bhakti in it just to make it work. Because on its own, karma won't work. On jnana won't work. So it's just got a touch. But for the devotee, the neophyte, then the bhakti is a greater aspect, and it's got some karma in it. Does that make sense? So in other words, the karma aspect is the smaller feature. For these materialists who are using bhakti to get what they want, then the karma is the major feature. It's not actually the working principle. It's you've done that, and because you're sincere enough, you've done it nicely, therefore the Lord gives his blessings.
Mm.
You followed it very, very nicely, so therefore he gives his blessings.
Mm.
Outbursts in an emotional state such as, O Yadunanda and Krishna, I turn to you, driven by fears of this fierce material existence. I am constantly chanting your sacred names, Hare Krishna. Kindly deliver me, give me mukti, or... O Supreme Controller, you are the Brahman. I have fallen into this deep well of illusion. Please pick me up and allow me to merge with you. Are examples of jnana vidha bhakti abhas. Again, some spiritual authorities have called this type of adulterated bhakti jnana misra bhakti, devotional service mixed with empirical knowledge, or aropya siddhi bhakti, seeking achievement through the artificial interpolation of devotion. Right, so it's an artificial interpolation because it's not natural. It's natural that you approach the Lord to get whatever is desired, but it's unnatural you approach the Lord and get something material. Right? But the point is for the devotee, it's prominently the devotional aspect. Does that make sense? So it means here is that the devotees kindly deliver me or give me mukti. It means the devotee's not looking mukti, meaning as in merging into the Brahman. He's looking mukti, get me out of the material world. So that's jnana misra. I'm performing devotional service. I'm hoping to free myself of all impurity so I get freed from material entanglement because the material world is so miserable and all this. Devotees talk like that. But that's jnana misra bhakti. Right? Because the point is not to get out of the material world to serve Krishna. It's to get out of the material world because it's bad. At the same time as they want to get out of the material world to serve Krishna. Right? But for the devotees, they only want to serve Krishna. So they don't care if they do it here or anywhere. So it's not an important element for them to get out of the material world. Right? Does that make sense? But we present these because we do have these mixes of karma and jnana. So therefore, when we talk about, if you follow the Vedic literatures, then you're, you know, you want to be a nice grihastha, you follow the rules, and the grihastha life will go nicely. Not that that's important, but because it's important to us. You know what I'm saying? Our family life's going nice, we're fired up in the temple, japa's going nice, you know, there's a fight going on in the house, we're sitting in the temple, we're not focusing, you know, or maybe we can't even chant, we have to go for a walk. You understand? It's important to us, therefore the Vedic literatures have given it. So that will be karma misra or jnana misra bhakti. But the predominance is bhakti. We want to ultimately, the ultimate sadhya is Krishna. And we understand the ultimate sadhana is devotion. So it's different from these others. You understand? Does that make sense? Yeah. It's not pure devotion, so therefore it's not ideal. But it's better than one has taken up the devotional process. So one shouldn't then therefore take a devotee who is performing this Arupya Siddha Bhakti and drop it down to the level of these others. But at the same time, as understand, it's lower levels of devotional service because it's not pure. Yes?
Well, I have a different question now.
Yep.
So we're discussing prominence here.
Yes.
Not putting things in boxes.
Means mechanics can be in boxes, but how that mechanics used, that's where the thing is. The same mechanics for karma, jnana, or bhakti are the same. The difference is what karma means. My mentality is my goal. What I want is sense gratification. Mukti, I want liberation. Bhakti, I want to please Krishna. But that service, let's say, I want to do an activity for Krishna. I want to offer arti. All three of them are doing it and they're following the same rules. So the mechanics of the arti are the same, the differences in the consciousness. So in other words, mechanics are in a box. But mentality, that's what's the difference.
And we would want liberation because our service to Krishna would work better if we're not entangled.
Means if we want to be freed from material entanglement so that we're not distracted by that, so we can focus on pleasing, remembering and serving Krishna, that's fine. But the point is just that material world is so difficult, you know, when will this problems end and it just be that's the yeah. Yeah. Is this it? Yeah. All such apparently devotional activities are very distinct from Shuddha Bhakti. In other words, we're always defining Shuddha Bhakti. That's what we're trying to get to. So even if one's a devotee, then the point is what's the weakness that it's not pure devotion? Right? What is pure devotion? What's not pure devotion? So you know what to do and what not to do. Right? So that's there. And then for a materialist, then, you know, what is devotion, what's not devotion? So you bring out those aspects, like just like we're saying. You can talk to generally any monotheist about developing love for God, having that relationship with God. So those are the aspects of bhakti in their process. But the problem, they don't catch that, because then after doing all that, they want to go to the heavenly planets. Right?
They don't see the difference.
No. You know, and even the yogis and that, you can even many times talk about this. But then their idea is that after that, then you'll merge. So those elements of bhakti are there. So the point is you cultivate those in the person, And then you point out that, but therefore, since it's about devotion and love, why we should be wanting something for ourselves. We should, therefore, it's not about going to the heavenly plan. It's not about, it's about pleasing God. And they'll agree with that. Mm. Does that make sense? So it's still, the preaching is about what's pure devotion and what's not. So it's just a matter of a scale on how far away from pure devotion they are and how not, and where they're rightly situated. Right? So in other words, the neophyte is rightly situated. If he's not, he's not so well situated. He's performing it, but it's not actually an important or major aspect of his life. But for the devotee, then bhakti is the major aspect in his life. But by habit, he still has aspects of karma and jnana. So, yeah. All such apparently devotional activities are very distinct from shuddha bhakti. The quality of bhakti described by the Supreme Lord in the shloka of the Bhagavad Gita 6:47, which we have previously quoted, is shuddha bhakti. Of all yogis, the one who with great faith always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, is the most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So when he says, that's my opinion, that means he is a person, is Bhagavan, that's his opinion. So it's not a principle of Paramatma or Brahman. Right? Because the other recommendations might be a recommendation on the level of Brahman, or on the level of Paramatma. Right, do this work and then you'll get good results. Do this work, you get bad results. That's Paramatma. Right? Mm. Or let's say, because this is what the scriptures say, this is your duty, like that, that'll be Paramatma. Mm. You do this, this gives a good result. You do that, it gets a bad result. That's Brahman. Mm. Right? Does that make sense? But this is, you do it because this is my opinion. Mm. This is what I do. This is what my devotees do. Like that. So you always have to note those ones, is that Krishna's saying so many things, and they're all correct. But the ones where he says, this is my opinion, then those are your Mahabhakyas. Yes. Right? Those are the ones to watch out for. Right? So also, an important thing to note is that the acharyas have no problem re-quoting a verse even though they just quoted it in the same section. Mm. Like that. Means according to modern writing that you learned in high school, you don't do that. That's a no-no, right? You know, you're going to lose marks for doing that. Mm. But the point is then you don't know what's improminent. Right? That he's quoted this twice in basically, you know, within a page. Mm. That means it's very important. Right? According to Mimamsa. Anything repeated, anything glorified is important, so that you can understand this is essential. So in this other way, what they're basically teaching you to do is in a way that somehow or another you don't, natural ways of showing importance you don't use, and somehow or another you have to do it by another way. You understand? So it's not very direct. The shuddha bhakti is our sadhana. And in the perfected stage of shuddha bhakti, shuddha bhakti is transformed into prema. The two paths described as karma and jnana are simply related to bhukti and mukti, respectively. They do not constitute the means to guide the jiva to his highest eternal perfection, prema bhakti. Right? Only bhakti gives bhakti. Right? But as we mentioned, the forms, sometimes the forms are the same, because the point is. If the material world is a reflection of the spiritual world, that means it's the devotional activities of the spiritual world that are reflected here. So the mechanics stay the same. The perversion is the mentality. Then when we leave that Vedic reflection, means, in other words, the reflection of the activity as they do it in the spiritual world, and it's done here, we call that Vedic. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. When we give that up, then it's perversion of the perversion. Mm-hmm. Right? So in other words, you can follow the Vedic culture, but not do it in bhakti. Mm-hmm. And that's a perverted reflection. Mm-hmm. You're following the Vedic culture, doing it with bhakti, that's devotional service. Does that make sense? No? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Right, yeah. So, in other words, we have to be able to discriminate, is that bhakti, it's not that the activity, oh no, but you're doing this activity, so that defines it as bhakti, karma, jnana, or bhakti. No, it's the mentality that defines it. Right? Yes.
Could it be the opposite, where you're doing something that externally?
Of course.
Not bhakti.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting. That was what that gap was before. I was waiting for that mathematical option. The point is one starts from there. But that generally one would, if there's an option to perform the Vedic, one would do because it's Krishna's preference. If one doesn't have the option, like, you know, if you're traveling, you know, on the highway and you drive into the gas station, you go to the bathroom there, you don't have the option to wash your feet, so you don't, you know, so it's just not available. But when it is available, then you take it, you know. It's just, so that's the idea, is that the main point is that it's offered to Krishna, it's done to please Krishna. That's the main thing. But then there's the point is Krishna is a person, so what actually pleases him? You know, just like I may try to buy a gift for somebody. So I try to buy something I think would be nice. But then there's the principle of what do they think is nice. That's a higher principle. But that you're doing it because you want to get something nice for the person, that's devotion. That's proper. But that's the difference. What Krishna is saying is that you're doing the thing and giving it to him, or you're starting with him and therefore doing what he wants. That's the Sarvadharma and Paritya. Is the difference is, do I start with myself and offer that to Krishna, or do I start with Krishna and then myself engage in that? That's the difference. So it's subtler. But here is yeah. So okay. So means the man is there, he's just bumped into the devotees, you know, so he goes home and now he offers whatever it is, you know, his TV dinner to Krishna. Right? It's not exactly something you'd offer, but the principle that he understands that this has come by God's grace. And that he has that's devotion. What he's offering is not actually offerable, but at least the devotion that he's offered. So he starts from there. But because he started there, it's not that 10 years later you can say, well, he did that 10 years ago, it's all right to do today. That would be, you know, that's like saying when I was, you know, 1 year old, I peed on the floor, you know, but so now it's all right to pee on the floor. You know, no, you one matures. Like,
can you apply that principle to Jnana Mishra Bhakti? Say, you should want to go back to a new devotee. Say, you should want to go back to Godhead. Read about the spiritual world. You
yes.
want to get out of
yes.
there.
Yes.
Because desire
yeah.
is there.
You're dealing with karma and jnana. You're dealing with this is a place of misery and this and that. But there it's nice. You know, then it's they've changed their view. But once they've changed their view, then you can tell them why it's nice. It's because of that love. So we say those things, but they're going to more catch the... It's not nice here, and it's nicer there, and we want to get out of here, and like that. You'll be happy there, you won't be happy here. So, elements of karma and jnana, which are correct, but it's just their motive for it is karma misya or jnana misya. But the point is because the predominance is actually trying to develop love for Krishna, it's counted as bhakti. Right? It means it has the aspect of aropya siddha. Right? In other words, you're putting onto it your desire. But it's not the prominence. But the point is when you're talking about Shuddha Bhakti, anything other than Shuddha Bhakti is not Shuddha Bhakti. Right? So therefore we'll make the distinction. But the distinction we're talking about is the little fleck rather than, you know, a very big rock.
Well, I was thinking when you were saying that someone would say, well, if I'm gonna preach, I'm not gonna preach Jnana Mishra Bhakti because it's the wrong thing. Or sometimes, but actually Prabhupada would preach that way for people to sit on stage.
Yes, but he would always point out the Shuddha Bhakti. Like that. It means he'd catch that, but he would talk Shuddha Bhakti. The thing is that if we use soft preaching, that we never talk about Shuddha Bhakti, it's not soft preaching, it's just soft. You know? That's all. You know, that's the weakness. Because soft preaching means you could say Jiva Dharma, that's soft preaching. It very pleasantly, in the particular language of the person they're talked to, exactly gives them pure devotional service. But it uses their language, their goals, or this to take them step by step through to pure devotion. So you have to end with pure devotion. That's soft preaching. You know, rather than just in your face. It just means, I use my language in my tone to you, it doesn't matter what it is. So, but that just means that's what we've done is enthusiastic, you know, preaching, but it's not actually mature preaching.
The concept of soft preaching, that's actual mature preaching. But the concept that you define nowadays as soft preaching is not actually preaching.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you use a few little this and that kind of terms and all that, but the point is you have to give Vedanta. It's just you do it in language, because that's the point, is Vedanta, by this, the Vedas are explaining it through karma and through jnana. So it's easy enough to do. The Vedas give the best way of doing that. It means you got whole sections of the Vedas that are just written in that way. But the point is they do make the conclusion, which we have a tendency not to. But the point is that if we understand it right, we know how to say the conclusion in a way and language that they appreciate. You know? Because if you talk about Brahman and talk about the Supreme Brahman, and talk about developing love and that relationship between ourselves and the Supreme Brahman, then you said the right things, but it's language they can catch. Because how do you have a relationship? Because relationship, if you merge, that's not a relationship. So you've already gone beyond mukti. But you've used terms that they can appreciate. And then they'll say, well, how to do that? And then we say, by chanting, by doing this and that. And, you know, and then, like you said before, of all yogis, means the yogi is the best, but then of yogis, the bhakti yogi is the best. You know? So I mean, this verse here is, you know, this verse, what is it? The yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, greater than the fruitive worker. Therefore, Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. And of all yogis, one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, renders transcendental loving service to me, is the most intimately united with me in yoga, is the highest of all. I mean, you could say that at any yoga center and get away with it. You know? But you have to point out, what are the different things? What are all those like that? You have to do, just use their fancy language. They'll buy it. The point is the soul by nature will buy it, unless they're atheistic. But then those ones are the ones we avoid. So that means all the innocent, no matter what they are, they'll all buy it. You just have to find the language that they'll be comfortable with. So, yeah. Thank you.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Chanitai Ki Pour Premanandi.